You're listening to Rick Kleffel, the Agony Column podcast. You can find additional reviews, interviews, print interviews, and book commentary 5 days a week at trashotron.com/agony.
Terry tilts his head in the direction of the stairs and Hurley steps out of the shadows. How the hell I missed Hurley is a tribute to my lack of awareness. The guy is a giant, really, 6'8 and over 350. And on top of that, he just happens to be one of us. So what you've got here is your basic gargantuan Irish vampire. Oh, and he's retarded. I shouldn't say that. What I mean is he's dumb as a sack of hammers. Whether he's actually retarded, I don't know. I sit back down. Sure thing, Terry. You got a question. Shoot. Terry smiles and nods. See, man, that's the way it should be. Just two guys sitting and talking. People. People talking about their problems with each other, finding solutions. If everybody could do this, if we could get the world together like this, we could change everything, man. Like, for instance, my problem is this thing last night, this whole hassle over the, well, it used to be a community center, man, but pretty soon it's going to be another yuppie co-op. But anyway, this thing over at the old center, this hassle with the zombies. Tom jumps out of his chair. That's what I'm talking about. That right there. We rejected that term, man. We voted. They're not zombies. That belittles their status as victims, man. They're infected, not in control of themselves. And creeps like this stooge are still going around slaughtering them. Terry bobs his head. Well, you have a point there, Tom. The term zombie does put the onus on them for their actions and implies blame. So, what was the term? VOZ, victim of zombification. Lydia finally pipes up. I'm still opposed to the use of the word victim. It suggests weakness, helplessness. Terry holds up his hand. I think you might be right there, Lydia. But for now, as regards the conversation I'm having here with Joe, could we agree that VOZ is a valid term? Tom and Lydia look at one another and nod. Good. See, Joe? People solving problems.
Charlie Houston is the author of the Hank Thompson trilogy, which includes Caught Stealing, Six Bad Things, and A Dangerous Man. He's also the author of the Joe Pitt Casebooks, a vampire noir series that includes Already Dead and No Dominion. Welcome to the program, Charlie.
Thank you for having me.
Charlie, let's talk a little bit about your biography. Tell us how you grew up with genre fiction, how you discovered it.
Very young. I had an older cousin who was a huge fan of Tolkien and The Lord of the Rings. And every time I'd go to visit that house, he would tell me a little more of the story. I didn't know how to read yet, and so he was just obsessed with it, and he would tell me little bits and pieces, and eventually ended up, over the course of several months, telling me the whole Lord of the Rings story, and he would also quiz me on who the characters were. So I can remember I'd show up and being asked, okay, who's Frodo, and what's his uncle's name, and who are the Wraiths? And so this kind of got the idea of fantasy into my head, and I learned to read late. I didn't learn how to read until I was 5 or 6. And once I started, I almost immediately started reading fantasy and science fiction and eventually horror and mystery and all things genre.
Your work is very noir. It's very violent. Now, you grew up in Oakland. I'm wondering, was Oakland a violent place back then?
I didn't actually grow up in Oakland. I was born in Oakland. I grew up in the East Bay in a decidedly unviolent suburb called Livermore. There is nothing in my personal history, I think, to suggest or imply the buckets of blood, the broken bones, the fusillades of bullets. I'm still trying to piece together where the violence comes from.
Well, let's talk a little bit about violence. When you write about violence in the Hank Thompson books and in the Joe Pitt books, there's a lot of it. It's very well described. As a writer, do you have to choreograph it for yourself, like work out the moves as to when two people, when you're describing about a fight and people are, you know, stabbing one another and punching one another and wrenching one another's limbs off and backwards, do you work those moves out yourself?
The limb wrenching in particular, that's always tricky. Yes, there's definitely a choreography that's involved. There are a couple things going on. One is that I always want the violence to have some kind of an impact, and I want it to have an impact on, this is more so in the crime books than in the vampire books. I want it to have an impact on the characters who are committing it and on whom it is being inflicted, and an impact on the reader as well, which has something to do with how graphic it tends to be. I also want it to make sense. There are times where it's over-detailed sometimes, and it becomes burdensome to try and describe There's a fight sequence in my first novel, Caught Stealing, that takes place in a small bathroom between Hank, who's a big guy, and a much smaller opponent. Hank is incredibly outmatched by the smaller opponent, and trying to describe the details of how the smaller opponent gets the upper hand and why and how the space affects the fight was very important to me. And it's just become habitual now. I tend to see the things fairly vividly, and I want to try and communicate them as vividly as I see them in my head. And sometimes they get a little hyper detailed, and I think it bogs down the narrative a little bit, and that's what editors are for.
Let's talk a little bit about Hank Thompson. He's an interesting character. He's a bartender who becomes involved in a typical Hitchcock manner in an escalating series of increasing violence.
Hank starts as a bartender and a one-time baseball protege who has no real violent inclinations other than the ones required for, you know, by being a bartender in New York. Which mostly has to do with, just speaking from my own experience as a bartender in New York, is just has to do with a sense of self-preservation and realizing that by just being sober, you tend to be several IQ points, dozens of IQ points superior to the average drunk, which means there's usually a solution to any kind of, you know, potentially physically threatening situation that arises in the bar. So Hank is not a fighter at all. I've thought a lot about this book now because it's been years since I've written it, and why it's so violent, and what I think it's about, because it is a very simple plot, and it is very much just the classic wrong man Hitchcock scenario where Hank has something he doesn't know he has, and people want it and they pursue him, and things get worse and worse and worse and worse for him until he is initially driven to do things in seeking self-preservation, hurts or kills people without trying, and in the end kills people quite deliberately, and not out of self-preservation, but for revenge. When I think about the book now, I think about it in terms of being a book about what, then this speaks back to what I was saying before about wanting the violence to have an impact, about what violence does to people. I don't believe that, as it occurs in a great deal of genre fiction, whether it's on the page or on TV or in movies, most of the time violence has very little impact unless somebody's wife is being killed or their child is being killed. You generally see people, particularly when it's inflicted on themselves, you know, once they heal coming through this without being a different person, and you see people who do horrible things themselves, and then when, you know, the book is over, their lives just return to normal, and that just doesn't seem right to me. More than anything, the Hank Thompson trilogy to me is about what happens when extreme violence collapses in on an otherwise normal life, and particularly what happens when a man is driven to willfully commit acts of violence, and how that might change a person.
One thing that interests me is your books have a lot of anger in them. I mean, it seems that there's a bristling anger beneath the surface of your writing. Do you have to work up this bristling anger, or do you just, once you step into the character, do you just acquire it?
Can I start using the F word yet?
Sure.
I'm not a angry person particularly. I'm fairly laid back, which is not to say I'm not prickly or anything like that. But I do believe that what is in there is coming out in the books. And that part of the reason that I think in day-to-day life I'm a pretty laid back, mellow person is because it's all vented in my fiction. I'm more angry with every passing day, as a matter of fact. And it's not about personal things, because I've got about as good a personal life as I think that a human being has a right to think they could ever have, in terms of great personal relationships and a wonderful wife and lovely, you know, family and parents and a great occupation and I'm knocking my head here in lieu of wood to knock on. And all of those things. But I'm deeply distressed at the condition of the world, and my distress is often felt in the amount of bile gurgling up my esophagus and wanting to vomit forth. As the world becomes relentlessly more and more violent around us, and I find that the level of violence in the books is escalating. And I also find it's easier when you asked about Oakland being a violent town earlier, if I came from a town that had where, Oakland has a reputation as being a hard town, the world is violent. I don't need to grow up in a violent town. I didn't need to grow up in a bad neighborhood. I didn't need to grow up in an abusive family. I didn't need to grow up, as part of a street gang to have violence, relentless, whether it's coming at you through fiction or just the real fucking world, man. And the level of it is frighteningly intense, and the graphic depictions of real violence are right there in the grill right now. I've got the front page of the New York Times right now, and I had to when I opened it up in my hotel room to look at over my breakfast this morning. I had to refold it because the right there on the front page is the latest series of bombings in Baghdad, and the photograph has, got gutters full of blood. So how hard is it to write about gutters full of blood?
I guess not hard at all. One thing that I think is interesting is the noir genre that you write in is noted for kind of a social realism. And I think one of the things that drives the anger is the luxury gap, the income gap. The noir characters operate at the lowest level, but they also have this kind of like hot wire to the people at the highest level. And it's the difference between those two that generates some of the violence. And I'm wondering how that informs your work.
There's kind of what you could call the noir demi-monde, that there is that in the same sense as the classic demi-monde of the aristocracy circulating with the whores and the artists and the thieves and whatnot. And that's, there's this that same aspect in is classic feature of noir, and it's that idea that the people with the most to lose at the top of the food chain, I think, sometimes need the people with the least of to lose to do their dirty work, because there aren't going to be a whole lot of, there aren't going to be a whole lot of rich private investigators, so they're going to have to go to another social level to access that. I don't know if it informs the violence particularly or the anger. But it's a natural place to find friction. If you've got a character, there's less of it in the Hank Thompson books, where it tends to be mo just almost exclusively bottom dwellers in that book. And when you find the wealthy characters, they're usually gangsters, with the exception of one well-paid baseball player. But in the Pitt books, which are actually, even though Joe is a vampire and he operates in a world that is rife with vampires, it's actually the more classically noir of the two sets of stories that I've been writing. Despite the horror trappings, it's much more hard-boiled, and it adheres to those conventions a little bit more. It creates it's great to have that friction between somebody who has nothing to lose, really, who says exactly what's on his mind, who doesn't give a fuck about what you think about him or anybody thinks about him, who is really just wants to survive another day for what fucking reason he doesn't really know. Other than that, just seems to be the way to go. So when seated across the room from someone who's used to being deferred to, and having their ass kissed, you get this great friction that's classic throughout the genre. And you also, I think it's going to be natural that you're going to get a certain stick it to the man attitude that's, going to come out of that.
Let's talk a little bit about noir. Tell us, what was your experience of noir literature? When did you first read it yourself, and why did you decide to write in that vein?
The first thing that I remember reading was Hammett, and I'm not. It was either The Thin Man or The Maltese Falcon. I'm not sure which. And I had seen the movies before that. And that was in my late teens, early 20s, was where I really discovered it. And to this day, I've read all of the Hammett and all of the Chandler and a great deal of Patricia Highsmith's work, which is not really noir, but she usually gets lumped in with those guys, and Jim Thompson and a handful of other writers, but I'm not very well read in the contemporary noir at all. One writer who I had I discovered in my mid-late 20s was James Ellroy, who's, you know, pretty much the strongest contemporary noir writer at his, when he's writing at his best, out there. And that was, those were books that I was reading right about the time that I sat down and started working on Caught Stealing. So that was probably the most direct noir influence. Really, the motivation was that I was looking for a creative outlet. I was living in New York working as a bartender, and I had been working in a theater company, and I was no longer working with the theater company. I wasn't doing anything creative, and I had always written as for fun, and so I was just trying to write something. I had never written noir, so I was really writing. I was enjoying the genre a great deal, and I wanted to write something to entertain myself. And so I started writing what I thought would be a short story, and just kept getting longer and longer and longer. And initially, Hank was, I planned Hank to be more like a Joe Pitt character, not a vampire, but a more traditionally hard-boiled detective kind of character. But I found that it was easier to write about a character who was a bartender with sore feet, because I was a bartender with sore feet. So that, you know, came a little more naturally and ended up being more interesting for me at the time.
Tell us a little bit about... Noir is an interesting way to do social commentary. And tell us a little bit about how you use some of those traditions of noir for social commentary.
It's never particularly conscious when it happens. And sometimes the places where it seems like it would be where it's the most literal are where it's the least literal. And Already Dead, the vampires are divided into clans that control different pieces of turf in Manhattan, and the most powerful is the Coalition, and it's very uniform, it's very homogenous and rigid, and you know, with shades of fascism. But I wrote those, and the parallel, the obvious parallel to make, the obvious connection to make, is to coalition forces in the Middle East, and implications about the current presidential administration and all of that. But I wrote the first 100 pages of that book, including naming that clan, the Coalition, in 2000, I think. So I had slapped that on there long before that was an issue. Sometimes it's not. I don't feel like so. It's so much commentary. Having there's a clan in Harlem called the Hood, and I don't even know how much of it is commentary. I would say as observation. It's just there is racism, and there are race relation problems, and it's not possible to write about a clan of vampires. Who are predominantly African American without dealing with race relations and the fact that, you know, a lot of white people and black people and brown people and red people and yellow people and, you know, really have a lot of fucking problems with each other and don't like each other. One place where it is really concrete is I refer to a settlement of coalition of vampires living on Hood turf as a settlement, and I refer to it as their West Bank settlement, and that was conscious, and that had a lot to do with just the news of the day. And at one point, I talk about moving Joe being transported between coalition forces or coalition camps in terms of rendition. And when I was writing that, it was when rendition was a big story in the papers, when suspected terrorists were being extradited from United States or European Union soil to countries that had different policies about what kind of physical force and means you could use in interrogation. And I read this term in the paper, extreme rendition. And just the sound of it alone is frightening. And then when I was reading about it, then the process was in my mind, and it seemed to apply. So I know that part of the reason that noir is good for this stuff is the same thing we were talking about before, the meeting of the high and the low. So both ends of the social spectrum get to reflect on one another. And since it's a demimonde, the races mix as well, and the economic classes mix as well, and men and women mix in non-traditional manners. So there's always chance to observe these things. And I try not to, as a narrator, talk about them explicitly, but I do sometimes observe behavior or have the protagonist observing behavior and show things in the way the characters interact without talking about it too loud.
Let's talk a little bit about something called the pulps. You own the domain name Pulp Noir, and your work does fit into that. And one of the ways that it fits into it, you mentioned that it'd been years since you wrote Caught Stealing, but you know, it's only been 3 years, and we've got 5 books from you. That's a pulp-like pace for writing. So I'm wondering how you write so fast and quite well, and how that if the tradition of the pulps of grinding stuff out at a rapid pace, how that informs your work.
Grinding is the word, man. It's been longer. Caught Stealing was written in 99, I think.
Oh, okay.
So it was written well before publication. However, since 2003, which is I believe when that book was sold, I've now, in addition to the 5 books that are published, I've written, there are 2 more that are done that will be published in the next year. So I've written six books since then, and the pace is about 2 a year so far. And on top of that, I do some work writing in comic books and some other sidebar work. And it was this was something that I wrote about a little bit on my website, and it was a revelation for me when I reached the point. Initially, it was just an opportunity that I had the chance to sell these books and to not be bartending and to not have sore feet, which was glorious. And so just writing and not thinking about it too much and making choices, because you have to make choices. And it was only in the last year or so when I'd start reviewing manuscripts and going over proof pages and layout pages and seeing things that I really wished I could change or take back. But it was either too late in the process or the next deadline was already pressing too much that there wasn't a chance to do it. And the books still held together well as they were. But there were times when I wished I could pull out a whole subplot and rewrite it and really have a little more space to make these choices. And it was only then that I had this kind of revelation that I went, oh, pulp. It's, you know, the defining factors of pulp are not necessarily, you know, large-breasted women and laser guns and you know, 45s and fedoras and, you know, tough guys and malls and tentacled monsters and stuff. The real defining feature of pulp and why it has wonderful inconsistencies and a reputation as for having a real simplicity of style and a real directness of style and a lack of long descriptive passages about, you know, the glories of nature, is time. You know, the true pulp writers were grinding this stuff out and working on deadline and trying to pay the bills, and they had to write a lot of it, and they had to write it fast because they didn't get paid especially well. I make a lovely living being a writer, but it definitely is contingent upon me writing 2 books a year to do it. So I suddenly had this realization that. You know, I'm no longer, this isn't something I'm aping. This isn't something I'm aspiring to. This isn't a style I'm copying. I'm a pulp writer. I'm writing comic books and vampire novels and hard-boiled fiction, crime fiction. And I'm writing it on a schedule that means that when I get to the end of a corridor narratively and there are 3 doors, I don't get to sit there in the middle of the corridor and ponder which door and what might be beyond that door, nor do I get to pick one of the doors and go halfway down it and go, ah, door number 2, and run back down to door number 2. Once I pick door number 3, I got to keep going down that corridor. There isn't time to go back and change that. And that means if I get way down the next section and I realize that something isn't fitting, I got to find a way to make that fucker fit. Which leads to some, you know, there's a lot of knot tying at the end of the Pit books. There are a lot of loose ends that tend to get tied up. And there are some that I like to leave dangling. There are some that just feel right, just to leave them loose. And I'm starting to embrace all of that. There are things that were driving me crazy a year ago that I wanted to fix. I'm now realizing that a lot of those warts are just a part of the style. They're a part of the genre. They're a part of what pulp is, and they're kind of wonderful. And it's also interesting now to go back and read not as much Chandler, more I find it more in Hammett, and definitely a lot of it in Jim Thompson, and read these guys and places where you're like, that doesn't make any sense whatsoever, or that doesn't fit, and realizing why those are there, that it's not necessarily bad workmanship or oversight. It is oversight, but it's also oversight and, you know, no opportunity to go back and fix it later. It's, you know, it's not as if I'm sure that some of these guys and ladies, men and women, wouldn't have preferred to have, you know, much more polished work sometimes. This is just what the market allowed.
Let's talk about the Joe Pitt books. These are our vampire novels that in which your character Joe Pitt is a vampire detective. Tell us a little bit about your concept of the vampire and why you chose to write in this particular genre.
It was less my choice and more the genre's choice. It was definitely it was a situation. Once again, I was trying to entertain myself. When I started the Pitt books, this was again well before I had sold anything, and wasn't really even thinking about selling anything. So I sat down after I finished Caught Stealing and put it in a drawer where I thought it would rest in peace. And fortunately didn't. I wanted to write something else, and I wanted to write something that was a little looser, a little shaggier, something where I didn't have to think quite as hard about how the violence would affect the characters, because I wanted to move outside of the real world, and I was a little worn down by that. I wanted something with a real tough guy who could do things with impunity and skill. And so
You mean getting the staples pulled out of Hank Thompson while somebody torments the cat wasn't tough enough for you?
wasn't so much. It was that was tough, but it wasn't. And he endures it well. But Hank, when Hank gets into a fight with someone, they until later on in the trilogy, they tend to be wounded or killed more, you know, by accident than by design. With Joe knows how to fight. Joe's a badass. Joe's a real tough guy. He's a real fighter. He's a real scrapper, and he doesn't mind using violence. Whereas Hank is always kind of tortured on some level when these things happen. Joe has no conscience about it whatsoever. He doesn't necessarily like his life, but you know, tear your ear off, sure, tear your ear off, no problem. Doesn't gross him out. Doesn't bother him. He's done it a half dozen times in the last week anyway. So what's the big deal? So I was trying to write something a little bit looser and for me funner, which again I don't know what that has to say about me or my upbringing, and cool was, you know, I was talking the other day to some readers, and I was saying one of the funnest things about writing the Joe books is when I come to one of those decision making points I was talking about, where I have to choose should I do A or choose B. Thinking about the implications on the plot is less of concern than thinking about which of these would be cooler. And then I'll worry about unraveling it later. Right now, I just need something cool. So that was it. There was I was just trying to write something that would be fun, and also and always trying to write something I would like to write. And then the mythology that I was constructed is not original to myself, as the I didn't think about it at the time. I knew that I wanted it to have vampirism to have a biological basis instead of a supernatural one, or at least for everybody to think it's a biological basis. So there's a virus that causes vampirism in these books, and I wanted to have, you know, talk about it in pseudoscientific terms. I have a biochemist friend who flinches every time, you know, he looks. He says, "Well, the fiction is good, but." And then he gets a little eye twitch when I say, "What, Steve? What about?" I'm exaggerating. So anyway, I wanted to do that. It was only later I was having a conversation with somebody, and Richard Matheson came up, who wrote a book called I Am Legend, which was made into a movie with Vincent Price, which was also made into a better known movie called The Omega Man. And in that book, he goes to great length describing the agency of vampirism as a virus. And it was only once I had that conversation with this friend of mine that I went, oh, that's who I stole that from. Because I knew I had seen it somewhere before, but I couldn't remember exactly where. All writing is cannibalism, in one form or another, all fiction writing.
And there's a bit of cannibalism in your books, too.
Oh, yeah, there is. we could argue about whether it's cannibalism for a vampire to drink blood. I haven't decided yet exactly how that fits in. Anyway, just having fun more than anything else.
One of the things that you're having fun doing is developing the backstory for your vampires. I'm wondering how much you knew in advance and how much you're exploring in the books.
Very little in advance initially, but when the opportunity came up to sell the Joe Pitt Case books to a publisher, one of the things that I needed to present was a Bible for the universe, which outlined how vampirism works, what are, you know, the different clans, all the kinds of details to give a publisher, a prospective publisher, some evidence that I knew what the hell I was doing and I had a plan. And this wasn't just because if you're proposing a series, they want to know that there's another book. They want to know there's book two, book two, book three, book four. So while initially when I started Already Dead, there was no real plan and I just kind of let everything evolve. When I did this, I had 100 pages done and I had to create some backstory. Some of it had, you know, some of it was there, but it got deepened when I did that. At this point, I pretty much know. At this point, I've completed the manuscript for book three and I'm projecting five books to wrap up the series. And I pretty much know where everybody's from, where they're going, and what revelations will come out about where everybody's been. But there was definitely a great deal, particularly in No Dominion in book two, of steering it, trying to steer characters in places that I didn't know for certain that was where they came from, or to steer them out of places I didn't know that's where they came from. I do a lot of because of the speed that I'm working at, there's always a great deal of, you know, thinking on my feet and making things up as I go along.
One of the things that I have to observe about your books is they're very funny. It doesn't matter. I mean, and the violence is funny, the vampirism is funny, and the language is funny. So I want to talk to you a little bit about the sense of humor that you have in your books. I think many readers might start to worry about themselves when they're reading, like, the scene in Caught Stealing, where they're popping the staples out of the guy and they've got the cat going over here and you're laughing. So what is it that you do as a writer to get that? Do you find that funny or?
Well, Rick, I don't think people should be worrying about me. I think they should be worrying about you. You're the one that's laughing. I've had people who have told me that they stopped reading, intimate friends who haven't read that book because they got to the staple popping and then the cat torture in particular, and they had to bail out. And I understand. I'm you're disturbing me. There are definitely places where I'm trying to get a laugh. There are definitely places where I'm trying to release a little tension or kind of play the mundane concerns of life against something completely fucked up that's happening. I'm very, very rarely trying to write something funny. It is almost always just kind of incidental to the voice and to the style and to what's going on. It was strange for me when the editor who bought Caught Stealing expressed to me that he thought of it first and foremost as a comic novel and as comic you know, crime, because to me I was like, there are horrible things happening in this book and look at the emotional trauma. But I understand it, you know, and I wasn't really all that confused. I mean, I got it. I understood it. And I knew that stuff was in there. And I know that Hank is particularly self-deprecating and bemoaning, you know, the bizarre happenings all around him. And I know that Joe is, profoundly sarcastic and cynical and hard-boiled to a comic extent in many places, and undercuts many situations by, you know, with his sarcasm. And there's, you know, there's absurdity in you know, hippie vegan vampires. That some of those moments, you know, victims of zombification is definitely played for humor. But I don't know. The cliche is that if you try to be funny, then, you know, you can't be funny. That part, I have no idea. I'm always delighted when people tell me that they think the books are funny, or when somebody writes me an email and they say that, oh, this just cracked me up. Somebody just recently wrote me an email and said that the part of No Dominion when Joe bites somebody's eye out made him laugh. And then later in the book, when the subject of him by having bitten this character's eye out comes up, they say he laughed again. And, I wrote an email back, and my email back said, yeah, eye biting, always good for a chuckle. It never occurred to me that would, you know, the later scene when he references it again. Yeah. But when he was actually doing it, never occurred to me that would be the least bit humorous. But I think being funny is really, really hard. So I'm always flattered when people think it's funny, and I kind of love it. And I think that that's where the best humor comes from. I think that when somebody's just trying to tell a story that they think that is a good story, and trying to tell it as earnestly and honestly as they believe it should be told, and there's a great deal of humor incidental to that, that's, you know, that's where I think you get the best laugh. So I've kind of stumbled into it for the most part, but nothing could make me happier.
It's a slapstick with chainsaws or eye biting.
Yeah, and you know, anybody who's ever seen Evil Dead 2 will know exactly what you're talking about. If you want a filmic reference to that style, and there are other scenes that are meant to be played very, very straight. There's a long action sequence at the end of Already Dead that takes place in the basement of an abandoned school, which is not intended to have any of that slapstick effect, but it's so over the top that I also, you know, it just, I think it, a lot of it is just state of mind. I think a lot of it is where somebody, who's, what somebody's sensibility is. I know a lot of people, the nonstop use of the word fuck, the nonstop bloodshed, it's not just offensive to some people, but unreadable because it hits them on a gut level so deeply, and they wouldn't see the unintentional humor, they wouldn't see the intentional humor, they wouldn't project any humor into it whatsoever, and it would just be, you know, not any kind of a moral or, you know, just a taste judgment. It would just be a gut level reaction to all of that. It would just be, this is awful, this is horrible, how can you even write about a world that's so relentlessly violent and grim and vulgar and, you know, and blood soaked? And I would say, well, did you see the front page of the New York Times today? How could I write about anything else?
One of the things that you do really well, you have great dialogue, and your dialogue is very funny and it's very easy to read. And you use the dash style of dialogue, somewhat poofy for hard boiled fiction. Tell us a little bit about the decision to go with the poofy dash style for your hard boiled dialogue. And do you listen to people? Do you like record people when you are, you know, hanging out at the bar? Or
ironically, I'm recording us right now, beyond the recording that's happening. I'm not actually. I just saw terror just came into Rick's eyes. I've got competition. No, I don't record people. I will occasionally overhear somebody say something that's, you know, my wife and I were having drinks with a couple recently, and our friend was telling a story about a night where he got hideously, hideously drunk in New Orleans several years ago. And he said, man, I wasn't just shitty, I was New Orleans shitty. And I immediately reached for a napkin because I knew that the phrase New Orleans shitty would end up in a book at some point. The poofy dash marks were symptomatic of two things. The first thing is that I'm a horrible typist, and a very slow typist. And since when I was writing Caught Stealing, it was for my own entertainment, and I never expected anyone to see it, I didn't bother using quotation marks because why? It just is. You just have to hit more keys and do more things with your fingers, and it just hitting the dash just was that much easier. And the reason for, you know, the dialogue just spills down the page with no he said, she said, they said, simperingly or, you know, apologetically. A big influence of that is that in addition to having been reading a great deal of James Elroy at the time, I was reading a great deal of Cormac McCarthy, and Cormac McCarthy writes his dialogue sans any indication whatsoever that it's dialogue. It rolls down the page, and sometimes it just rolls around with the prose and gets it on, and I liked the feel of it, and I liked that conversations went bang 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 bang, but there's very few indications. If you miss who has the first line in a sequence of dialogue, you're screwed. So there were a couple of things that I was trying to adapt to make work. One was using the dash mark, so it was a little bit. There was some indication that dialogue was happening, and trying to proceed sections of dialogue with the speaker taking some immediate action. So Rick reaches for his bottle of apple cider. Well, Charlie, the other thing, da 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 da, and trying to give some kind of lead off to who was speaking if there was some sequence of action that, you know, it comes in the middle of a sequence of dialogue. But I didn't realize at the time that the dash mark has, you know, a 19th century, you know, pedigree and a European pedigree. And because I'm an ill-read lout, I had no idea that James Joyce, you know, that I picked up a copy of Ulysses a couple of years back to take a crack at it. And I get to the, you know, first sequence of dialogue, and there are the dash marks. And I'm like, motherfucker, I'm ripping off James Joyce. It was, again, as with most of the stuff that I do, I am only recently starting to really think about writing, and it's probably the death knell. It's probably means doom and destruction and bad prose coming, you know, right around the bend. But initially, virtually every choice that I made was just made because I wasn't thinking about anything but entertain myself and writing in some fashion that worked for me, because I wasn't thinking about publishing and I wasn't thinking about anybody else reading it, and I wasn't thinking about how other people had done things. You know, I knew things that I liked, and I was just trying to do something with them.
When you write vampire novels, vampires are a powerful symbol. I mean, it really, once you bring up a vampire, it has all sorts of associations with aristocracy. I mean, the first vampires that most people saw were, you know, the rotting aristocracy of Dracula. I mean, they're not just, the aristocracy is literally undead. So I'm wondering what kind of symbolism you associated with the vampire for yourself when you first saw it, and how you intend it in your books, if at all.
I would say not at all. You know, I'm trying to think. I mean, to me, vampires were just scary. You know, when I was a sucker when I was, you know, well into my teens, I was a sucker for a horror novel or a horror movie in terms of it actually scaring me. Even, you know, old and bad. Actually, the older the badder, the better. But I can remember being scared by and still considering one of my favorite horror movies of all time is to be Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, which is a wonderful movie. And the real monster, the genuine monster sequences are actually really creepy and well done. So I don't know that I ever had a particular idea about vampires and what they could represent or what they did represent, other than they were just cool monsters. Likewise, I don't know that as an entity in the different clans are kind of evolving to represent, you know, or reflect different areas of society and different social groups and classes but vampires as a whole, I don't know if they symbolize anything for me or that I set out to, I don't know. That key hasn't turned in my brain yet. Based on the experience I've had reflecting on my work, I would expect in a year or two that there's going to be something that's going to kind of unfold in my brain, and I'm going to go, oh, maybe that's what I was writing about. But it hasn't happened yet with these books. I'm at a loss.
tell us a little bit about your vampire clans, because they are very funny and they're very separate. So tell us, explain to us kind of the setup for Already Dead and No Dominion.
In the most powerful clan is the Coalition. And initially, when I started Already Dead, I thought the Coalition would control everything. And
this is in New York.
This is in, I'm sorry, yes, in Manhattan. The books thus far are set entirely in Manhattan. They will expand to Brooklyn in the third book, but they will stay restricted to urban New York, New York City. I had initially thought that the Coalition, which is a very restrictive, rightward-leaning vampire clan that is concerned with secrecy and keeping its own hold on power and on the vampire clans that exist under the surface of day-to-day New York City, I thought they would control the whole island, and that Joe would be just kind of a rogue element in this world who managed to stay outside their authority by doing little favors and bits of business. Initially I had envisioned this opposing clan, this opposite number clan, the Society, which is leftward leaning, interested in trying to unite all the vampires in so that they can take the virus that causes vampirism public with a united front, and hopefully not just be eradicated the minute they become public or thrown into concentration camps and experimented upon. I thought that they would just be a small group of rabble-rousers in a couple of basements. I don't remember the moment that it kind of clicked over, and I thought that it was more interesting if the Society was a clan in and of themselves, and that they had actually fought a revolution in the late 60s and early 70s and broke off a part of Coalition territory. And the more I went down the road, the more interesting it became to have different groups. I think once I wrote the Society and wrote the Society in a style where they were reflective of a lot of the East Village revolutionaries that I would see and interact with when I lived in the East Village in New York. So the anarchists and the various minority rights groups and social rights groups and gender rights groups. And on and on and on and on, and it's not the heyday of the East Village for those things, but it's still, you know, a boiling point, it became fun, obviously, and there was a certain amount of satire that was, I hope, loving satire, I hope, that was present in there, and then I wanted to extend it a little bit, and so the Hood is the clan that exists above 110th Street and encompasses Harlem and Washington Heights and Inwood and the neighborhoods that are classically poorer and non-white and for the last well over 100 years now. Now I'm playing with a clan out in Brooklyn for what will be the third book, and some smaller clans on the lower tip of Manhattan. I referred to a couple times in one of the books, the Bulls and the Bears, without having explored them yet. But I've implied that there's a clan of stockbroker vampires for all intents and purposes down there, and that I may or may not get to later.
It's funny to read about hippie vegan vampires. What's nice about it is that, as you say, you get to identify and enjoy that there are the beliefs. The beliefs are presented in a positive manner, even though they're being presented by these bloodthirsty monsters. So tell us a little bit about kind of this tension of one of the things that how the vampire as a monster allows you to create characters who have a conflict that is itself somewhat humorous.
Okay, this is actually something that I can talk a little more seriously about, because it's something that I'm just with the, having just recently finished the manuscript for the third book, is kind of at the heart of the books. The more I think about it, is the idea of this tension between what the most of the vampires are trying to do is create some version of their old lives and trying to still live the way they lived before. And there will be these occasional voices that come from other vampires who will try to shock them out of this and try to say, don't you even understand? Don't you realize, don't you see that what you're trying to do is impossible? You are no longer that. You are beyond that, in whether for the good or for ill, you can't live your life that way. And it's a speech that's delivered to Joe a couple of times by a couple of different people, because he's still trying to exist in some semblance of a normal life. He hurts people, he kills people, he is not adverse at all to killing people to get blood. The only reason he's adverse to it is because it risks exposing him and putting him in physical danger. But essentially, he's trying to make money, rent an apartment. He's got a girlfriend who doesn't know he's a vampire, of course. And the real mechanics of his life are still trying to pull him towards being a normal guy. And in the same way with the members of the society, so the hippie vampires, these are people whose values are so intense and so strong, and whose beliefs are so intense and so strong, that even though they found themselves in a situation where they have to drink blood to survive, they can't leave that behind. They still believe those things, and their concern isn't about the grotesquerie of how they survive. Their concern is how to find a morally acceptable way to drink blood, how to find a way and how to deal with the fact that they now feel like they're a minority and that they're being discriminated against, and trying to find a way to put themselves back to where they think they should belong, that they feel like they're being oppressed by the coalition, the top power on the vampire food chain, and they feel like they don't have a they're not in a situation where they can risk exposing themselves to the real top power in the world, which is all the normal people out there, because they're afraid that if they do, they will, as I mentioned, get thrown into concentration camps, be experimented upon, be discriminated against as being not just specially abled, but discriminated against as being not human. And they can't get away from that mode of thought. The folks in the books that most embrace, the ones that are most suited to survival, tend to be the ones that most embrace their nature and say, I'm not that anymore. I am something else, and I need to live my life in some other way. So the ones that live in the sewer, the ones that segregate themselves and surround themselves with their own kind and essentially view humanity as a food source, those are the ones that are going to have the higher chances to survive, as opposed to the ones that are trying to integrate at some level and still trying to cling to who they were.
So a lot of this vampire work then does speak to social issues like marginalization, prejudice.
Yeah, but only only when I think about it, not when I'm writing it. As I said before, these things tend to just kind of open up. But it is an aspect. There's in the third book, there's a lesbian vampire who's part of the society, who appears in all three books, and who should just be a natural enemy to Joe, who is as biased and politically incorrect and dismissive of everything she stands for as you can imagine. But in some way, they are odd allies, because they're both have some level of belief in expedience and in want to get things done, and they have certain sympathies. And in the third book, the one that I just finished, they spend some time traveling together, and she has a chance to speak more fully than she has in the two books that have been published so far. And one of the things she talks about in the book is how little their lives have become because of the virus, how restricted that they are now, that they can, you know, only go out at night. They can only survive by, you know, a certain restricted set of actions. They can't travel. They can't expose themselves. And she talks about how she had been to Europe when she was a young woman and how she had been to Hawaii and she had, you know, traveled the world with her family and she had had all these experiences. And now everything is narrowed down to and honed to this one little point. So, yeah, there's those things are in the book. But as I say, this they only, you know, all of a sudden they just kind of pop out in little kernels in my thoughts. I never think about them. And then all of a sudden they're there. And I may be writing about them explicitly and at length. But then, you know, it's not until I have a conversation with someone like you that I went, well, then there is this. There is this. The whole book is basically about that. It's those strange things and not unique to me. I think that there's a lot of, that writers experience a lot of that.
Tell us a little bit about what's coming up from you. You finished the third book. What's it called?
The third book will be called, the working title was God's Mad Men, which is actually a line from Dracula. Van Helsing, when they're pursuing Dracula back to Transylvania, Van Helsing refers to himself and to the crew of vampires, hunters, as having become God's Mad Men. And religion plays a large role in the third book. So the working title was God's Madman, but there's a Dark Horse replacement title coming up the backstretch. It's a line in the book, and the line is Half the Blood of Brooklyn. So it'll either be God's Madman or Half the Blood of Brooklyn. And I'm starting to list towards Half the Blood of Brooklyn. God's Madman I might be able to use for a future book, but Half the Blood of Brooklyn, it's either this book or I won't be able to use it again, and I like it. And that'll be out around this time next year. And the only teaser I'm really willing to give on it is Joe Pitt Goes to Brooklyn and Half the Blood of Brooklyn gives away everything you really need to know. So that's done. And there's another book that's done that will be out earlier this year. That will be out in fall, I believe. And that's a standalone crime book called The Shotgun Rule. And now the Hank Thompson trilogy is done. I'll still be writing in crime. So I'm starting, I don't have a new series, and I don't know if I ever will have another series in crime, but this is a standalone set in the early 1980s about a group of teenage juvenile delinquents in a redundancy, a group of juvenile delinquents in a Bay Area suburb. Not too much should be read into that, anybody who's familiar with my biography shouldn't make too much of that, who break into the wrong house and steal the wrong thing and, trouble ensues. And that's definitely a book that's a little bit different from what's preceded. All the Joe books and the Hank books are all first person present tense. And so everything is from, the narrative style is by necessity similar and everything is from the protagonist's point of view, obviously. So you follow, sit on their shoulder as you drive through the story. This is a third person book and it's told with an ensemble cast, and the point of view moves around from chapter to chapter between the characters. So it'll be a little bit different, and it's a little different in tone. There's plenty of humor, but I think it tends to be a touch more somber. But I always think they tend to be a touch more somber, and then I find out that they're not.
Somebody tells you that biting
eyeballs is funny, you know. So you never know. I think it's hard to argue that this is a book that is definitely that's played, not only played less for laughs, but is just, even the incidental laughs will be fewer. There's still lots of humor in there. You can't have a group of teenage boys interacting without there being extensive use of the word fuck. And a lot of put downs and a lot of, you know, and just a lot of ridiculous bullshit going on. Right now when I'm traveling a little bit right now, and when I stop traveling, which will be very soon, I'll be starting work on a new novel, which will be an LA set novel. I just recently moved to Los Angeles and having written 6 books set in New York and knowing that I'm going to write at least 2 more Joe Pitt books set in New York, I wanted to break it up a little bit. And L.A. is obviously, you know, they're the three great noir cities are Paris, New York, and L.A. And, you know, London runs fourth. And I say that out of ignorance, having never been there. And LA, once you're living in it, it's there's I don't think there's any way you could live there and not and be a crime writer and not want to write something set in LA, because the sprawl and the variety just invites it and screams for it. So I'll be starting to work on an LA crime novel.
You know, one thing we haven't talked about is your ability to sling a blue language about. It's part of the charm of your work. I have to admit that in the latest Joe Pitt book, I was thrilled to find one of my favorite curse words, dickweed. This is not a word you find in books often. So tell us a little bit about how you keep that going. Do you have to, do you, when you revise, do you have to ratchet back? Do you find you have to ratchet back?
I assumed that it would be a. I thought a lot of things would be a problem when I sold Caught Stealing. I thought that that language would be a problem. I thought that the lack of quotation marks would be a problem. I thought that all kinds of changes would be asked for, and really they weren't. The one major change that we tried to implement was the cat changing the cat torture, and it just didn't work without it. Go figure. And I assumed that we'd be cutting some fucks out of there. And as it turned out, that was not an issue. And it wasn't until the second or third manuscript I was working on with my editor, and he sent it back with his cover letter, just talking about, things that he thought we should play with and tweak on it. And I was going down, the various points, and I get to one, and it says, words to the effect of, "Charlie, this will never be a G-rated movie, but I think we can afford to cut a few fucks out of this one." And my reaction, internally was, "What the fuck are you talking about? It's just fuck you. Come on. You know me. Fuck that. How fucking bad can it be?" So I cracked the manuscript, and he said, "Look, I've redlined a few of these." And I started going through it, and I started hitting some of the places where he had redlined the fucks, and I was like, man, he didn't take out half enough, because I had lines in that book. I think it was six bad things. It was probably I think that it was either six bad things or the first Joe Pitt. It was either that or Already Dead, and there were lines that were basically fuckety fuck fuck fuck, pages where I was just I couldn't get down the where it was just littered across, and they're still in there, but it was relentless, and I ended up cutting more than he had asked for, and now I find that I'm a little more conscious about it. And I find that when I do my revisions after I finish my first draft, I'm starting to cut a few because they're always going to be there, lots of them. But there are definitely places where it's serving less to emphasize and starting to de-emphasize a passage. And you can almost have a character make more of a point by not saying fuck in my book and have somebody's ears pick up and wow, they didn't use the word fuck. This must be really important. Or they're really angry. They didn't say fuck.
We've been talking with Charlie Houston. His new novel is No Dominion. His new latest Hank Thompson novel is A Dangerous Man. Thank you for speaking with me, Charlie.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me, man.
You're listening to Rick Kleffel, the Agony Column podcast. You can find additional reviews, interviews, print interviews, and book commentary 5 days a week at trashotron.com/agony.